Among the most enduring lines of poetry ever written are these: "Beauty is truth, truth, beauty. That is all ye know on earth and all ye need to know." John Keats wrote those lines in the early 1800s. These days, beauty's got a more complicated reputation. But Harvard literary scholar Elaine Scarry is trying to give the concept a makeover. So first off, what do we mean when we talk about beauty?
When we speak about beauty, sometimes we're talking about the beautiful object itself, which could be a child's face, or it could be a beautiful glass vase, or it could be a flower. Sometimes when we talk about beauty, what we're talking about is the experience that happens to us when we come into the presence of something beautiful. And over the centuries, we've had many gorgeous accounts of that, you know, starting with Plato's Phaedrus, in which we have a description of Socrates seeing a beautiful boy, breaking into a sweat, his knees buckle, he feels in his shoulder blades a prickling because he's beginning to grow wings as he begins to recall the immortal realm from which he's come. And then sometimes when we talk about beauty, what we're talking about is, again, what happens within the psyche of the beholder, but now not what happens just within the first few seconds, but what happens more enduringly. Just going back to Plato, for example, Socrates says that his teacher, a woman named Diotima, told him that beauty gives rise to the desire to bring children into the world, that when you see somebody beautiful, it creates the desire to create biologically, to create children. But Diotima then tells Socrates, it also gives rise to the desire to create legal treatises, poems, philosophical tracts, and so forth. And that idea that the beautiful brings about in us the desire to create is longstanding and occurs over many centuries.
Do you think that's true, that experiencing something beautiful awakens in us a desire or need to create, to add something to the world?
I do. I absolutely do. Wittgenstein said, when the eye sees something beautiful, the hand wants to draw it. You want to replicate the thing you've seen. And it may be, if one has a disposition towards drawing or a talent for drawing, that one does exactly what he says. But even if one doesn't have that, one carries out that act of replication by, for example, telling a friend about it or wanting to take a photograph of it.
See, I think of that as, I keep remembering the poet Wordsworth in college, and there's a very famous line about the desire to render something back, to give back. I think
Right. What
you're talking about is gratitude.
Well, that's a wonderful description of it. I would still say that it's an act of creation, that it awakens in one the desire to give back, to give thanks. But that requires an act of creation, whether it's a material act or a verbal act. You know, Wordsworth in Tintern Abbey says, what is it that happens to you when you look at these beautiful, symmetrical structures? And he says that what it leads to is the little unremembered acts of kindness and of love. So those are acts of gratitude or acts of thanks. They're also acts of creation because it's multiplied the beautiful itself.
I'm curious, have you ever heard a piece of music that was so beautiful it brought tears to your eyes? I mean, I have often. And what do you think that is? I mean, what happens when we encounter something so beautiful?
Well, I gave the description that Plato provides, that you're being brought into contact with the immortal. And even if one doesn't oneself believe in an immortal realm, I think that we would probably agree with Plato that we're sometimes, by beautiful things, put into contact with a metaphysical realm, or maybe one could say with our own best selves or with something greater than ourselves. There's a description that's given by two mid-20th century women philosophers. One is Iris Murdoch and the other is Simone Weil, both of whom say that when you come into the presence of something beautiful, you undergo an unselfing. Iris Murdoch talks about the fact that she's sitting there being preoccupied by the fact that maybe the world, maybe her colleagues, maybe her friends aren't treating her as well as she deserves. And then suddenly She sees a beautiful bird lift off the ground, but she could have easily said she suddenly hears a piece of music. And she says, "And I undergo an unselfing. Suddenly, I move to the periphery of my own world. I'm emptied of self." Simone Weil, the French mystic, said something very similar. She said, "We undergo a radical decentering." And I use an awkward term for this, which is opiated adjacency. And yeah, it's not a pretty term, but it's a very sensible term, because here's what it is. I say, there are lots of things in the world that give us acute pleasure. There are also lots of things in the world that make us feel marginal. But there's almost nothing other than beauty that does those two things simultaneously, that gives us acute pleasure at the very moment that it makes us feel marginal and happy to be on the margins, to stand back, to listen to the piece of music and just feel awe at what has been created.
So you've written that moments when we're just stopped in our tracks by something beautiful can make us see the rest of the world with fresh eyes. What did you mean?
I think that beautiful people and beautiful events raise our standard of perception. Sometimes people worry that a beautiful vase or a beautiful person will rob your attention from everyone else. The easiest case is you'll give inordinate attention to the beautiful person and not pay attention to those who don't strike you as equally beautiful. Mm-hmm. But I think the opposite in the long run is true. The next time you're stopped in your tracks by someone beautiful, ask yourself, were you walking along the street generously paying attention to people, or were you not paying attention to anyone? And then suddenly, like getting knocked on the head, awakened and made to give full attention. And then the next step is to say, but everybody deserves this level of attention, or that's the way one should perceive when one is being alive and alert, using the beautiful, whether in the realm of persons or the realm of music or poems, as a standard for greater care that should be distributed in general.
You titled your book On Beauty and Being Just, suggesting that you think there's a connection between beauty and justice?
I think there's a very strong connection between beauty and justice. I was surprised to learn that the word for fairness in the realm of justice, so in the realm of like fair arrangements, actually comes from the word fairness in the aesthetic realm, meaning loveliness of countenance or perfection of fit. If you think about each of the three sites of beauty that we talked about earlier, you can see the pressure towards justice in any of them. So, for example, in the case of the beautiful object, that beautiful object will have features such as symmetry, vivacity, clarity, unity, that I think anticipate those same features in the world of justice. And I use the example of symmetry. There have been great mathematical analyses of the strange mathematical workings out of the arrangement of both petals and leaves on plants, etc. That anticipates the much more difficult to bring about symmetry in the world of justice. There's a very famous 20th century account of justice by John Rawls, in which he describes fairness as requiring a symmetry in all our relations with one another. In fact, if one looks at accounts of justice from all different periods and all different philosophers, it almost always entails symmetry. So Plato talked about the fact that there ought to be a symmetry between crimes and punishments. To me, the opposite of beauty, I never use the word ugliness, I don't quite understand what it is, but I understand injury as an opposite to beauty. Somebody might worry, well, if we say that injury is the opposite of beauty, does that mean then if my legs both break, does that mean that I'm outside the realm of beauty? Well, here's what I think the answer to that is. Human beings have to be opposed to injury. They have to, when they look at injury, recoil. That may mean if they look at me with broken legs, they don't see me as beautiful, they recoil. But that actually in the long run is a good thing because it means that we try to stop injuries. And if we see an injury, we say we've got to do everything we can to repair it. Mm-hmm. And if we can't repair her legs, then we're going to redesign our city so that walking on one's legs isn't as important. We'll put ramps on buses. We'll put ramps into buildings. Hmm. But we have to remain opposed to injury. So I think part of what's happening when we look at the beautiful is, in fact, an aversion to injury. Now, for a while, biologists were claiming that other creatures that choose their mates on the basis of their beautiful feathers or their beautiful display or their beautiful songs or the beautiful nests they can weave, that they're doing that in part because it convinces them that their mate is very healthy and will have healthy offspring.
Right, I think it's really been a utilitarian.
Yeah, and it shows that there is an association, even in the non-human world, with non-injury and beauty, that symmetrical wings on the butterfly are the best predictor of a capacity to endure in the world without injury.
Elaine Scarry is a literary scholar at Harvard. Her book is called On Beauty and Being Just. You can hear my uncut conversation with her, including her thoughts on why in academia talking about beauty has sometimes been taboo. That's on our website, ttbook.org.